And welcome to another episode of the Fifth Estate Podcast. I'm Jake Caruso, deputy editor of the Washington Examiner magazine. Ben Howe will be here shortly, but our guest this week from Commentary Magazine, Noah Rothman, is here. Hey, Noah, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So a couple things we want to talk about, including 2020 and some other stuff. But I wanted to start off this conversation delving into some foreign policy, which is not something that we normally discuss on this podcast, but that's kind of, you have that background, and you wrote a very interesting piece on Commentary called Iran's Liberal Conspiracy Theorists. And you want to just go ahead and give a little background on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I suppose there's been this contradiction at the heart of the liberal narrative against Donald Trump's conduct of foreign affairs for some time. It obtains on the part of his critics that he is a warmonger in the mold of just about any other Republican, such to the point, in fact, that he is indistinguishable from another Republican, and that he is spoiling for conflict with Iran. And the experience that all of us have over the course of this last 2 months, which has been typified by escalating, egregious, aggressive provocations conducted by Iran and its proxies in concert with the intelligence that we suggested those attacks were forthcoming, has been restraint on the Trump administration's part, verging on negligence, I would say, to the point now where we're beginning to see provocations that demand a response, that require us to impose costs on Iranian actions, lest we sacrifice our position as the guarantor of global, unfettered, international free navigation of the seas and commerce. And there are real downsides for American hegemony if we were to sacrifice that position. So there's the notion here peddled on the part of the conspiracy theorist side is essentially that this is all smoke and mirrors, is that Donald Trump's true intention is to execute a war with Iran, and all evidence notwithstanding, this conclusion exists without any real empirical support.
And you have to appreciate the irony of particularly Democrats, Nancy Pelosi and some others, who have gone out and lambasted President Trump for disagreeing publicly with his intelligence community about issues related to Russia. That they're essentially doing the same thing, well, not necessarily the same thing. They're accusing them of doing the same thing they did in Iraq, which is cooking the intelligence to be able to get a war that they want. But if there's anything that's been indicated by Trump and most of his administration in the past, the last thing they want to do is go to war. Is that correct?
It seems to be. First of all, it's not what happened in the run-up to the Iraq war in the first place. They have internalized a version of events. Right. That simply doesn't comport with reality. But yeah, I mean, they're consulting their experiences from the past in order to fill in the blanks in the situation that they don't have all the information to really form a fully formed conclusion. And the conclusions that they're drawing just don't make any sense. The initial claim on the part of people in early May, when we started moving assets into the region, B-2 bombers and an aircraft carrier, a couple thousand troops, were nowhere near sufficient to conduct offensive operations. But they might be sufficient to deter certain aggressive actions on Iran's part because they could be retaliatory. That was said to be by people like the New Yorker's Robin Wright and even Representative Jim Hines and Senator Chris Murphy as provocative to the point of desirous of causing Iran to engage in provocations, to engage in activities that would compel us to respond, thereby justifying some sort of a broader attack. But if that was the plan, you would see a bigger buildup. They just sort of gloss right over that. And then it turns out that this intelligence was pretty much correct. On May 12th, there was a very sophisticated attack on four ships, a Norwegian-flagged vessel, two Saudi oil tankers involving fast-moving boats, precision divers, beneath-the-waterline mine placing, and it was the kind of stuff that state actors do. It's not the stuff of terrorists. And that's what they what these nations, the UAE, the Saudi Arabian government, and Norway testified in testimony to the United Nations Security Council that this was an activity done by a state actor. That state actor was, according to the United States, Iran. And this was, again, to the people like the American conservatives Gareth Porter and Professor George Lakoff and Bernie Sanders, more evidence that Donald Trump is spoiling for a war with Iran. Well, we have our casus belli, and the president hadn't done anything about it. Fast forward a month later, an even more sophisticated assault on tankers occurred, this one involving another Limpet mine and several fast-moving boats, very similar to the other attack. And this, too, was demonstrative of the Trump administration's desire to get into a war with Iran. People, including Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes, insisted that our claims that Iran was behind this are not being believed by the international community because Donald Trump personally has such a strained relationship with the truth, to the point where Rhodes said, quote, the United States was isolated in trying to pin the blame on Iranians. It wasn't true at the time. The British were backing our claim. It's doubly untrue now, as the Germans have done so as well. But it's, again, this is, it exists all independent of evidence. You had Nancy Pelosi saying, you know, quote, what is their motivation to be provocative with the Iranians, speaking of the United States and Trump? Why, of all the countries in the world, did the president of the United States choose the first country to visit Saudi Arabia? She added, follow the money. This is the stuff of real conspiratorial thinking. I mean, grassy knoll kind of stuff, the stuff that would get you laughed out of a room full of serious people. And yet it is being accepted as a reasonable political commentary, responsible political commentary from the arbiters of discourse that would otherwise not tolerate it in anybody else except opponents of the Trump administration. It is utterly indefensible and an abdication of the media's responsibility to call people like this onto the mattresses to explain themselves when they act in such an irresponsible fashion. And no one is doing it.
Yeah, that was going to be my next point, my next question with you, is that the media, for all of the, you know, all of the talk that we've heard over the last 2.5 years since Trump has been president, is we try to get to the truth. We want to get, you know, all that people deserve to know the truth. And this is one incident which in the scheme of things, in things that, you know, the general public pays attention to, is probably far down the list for the most part. But at the same time, you're right. Ben Rhodes goes on MSNBC anytime he wants to and says these things without challenge. And you have to wonder, where is that those truth tellers in this respect saying, you know, you find it in the stories, you know, for instance, you'll find something buried 10 paragraphs down. I'm not saying it's on purpose. I'm just saying it's there that a New York Times story will say, well, you know, Great Britain, like you said, did agree with the intelligence assessment of Iran, but it's never front and center. You know, there's nothing that sits there and says, you know, there's something that says, you know, I'm losing my train of thought here, but there's nothing that says boldly, yes, intelligence, groups of intelligence, or more than just the United States, agree that these attacks are being perpetrated by the Iranian regime.
Yeah, I suppose healthy skepticism is a virtue, but there's a point at which it becomes mania. We've seen now, or just pure cynicism. I mean, we've seen people people who try to justify this sort of thing. You mentioned the Iraq War. Bernie Sanders consults something a little closer to his experience, the Gulf of Tonkin. They have to reach back into history to justify their claims, some of which are not necessarily even justified by the events that they're citing. But it's nevertheless illustrative of the what their thought process is, which is divorced from the actual events that we're supposed to be talking about, and is more in line with their personal experience and how they perceived events in a more formative period of their young adulthood. And that's not reason, that's not logic, and it's not debate. I mean, it's just more like posturing. And it shouldn't be taken seriously. It's the sort of thing that should be laughed off, but it is being taken seriously by too many people, I think, who should know better. Now, overnight, we had an assault on an American asset, an unmanned surveillance drone. And this is being dismissed as, you know, it's not a really big deal because we didn't lose any bodies in the process, just a lot of treasure. But I mean, a whole lot of treasure. We're talking about a $120 million drone. This isn't a small plane either. It's a 100-foot wingspan. These things are big, and it's a big loss. And when we lose intelligence assets in the Gulf of Hormuz or the Strait of Hormuz, incredibly strategic asset, that if it were to close, we would be firing assets off of whoever closed it within hours, because it is such a strategic choke point that it's the sort of thing that we can't afford to lose. I mean, it is an absolute severe provocation, an incredible escalation. And the pattern of escalatory behavior on the part of Iran suggests, A, they're desperate for a response on the Trump administration's part. The administration is telling anybody willing to listen that it's Iran that wants to provoke a response here for a variety of reasons, most of which they think would be an over miscalculation on America's part. It would increase social cohesion and create a rallying around the regime effect, because internal tensions have been strained by the administration's sanctions regime. The sanctions regime is really hurting, and it's going after blue-collar workers in Iran, which is the backbone of the theocratic regime's support. So a strike, in their view, would help reorient the political situation, help the public to forget about the sanctions, and remind them of their antipathy towards the United States. So it's them that's trying to provoke this response, and the Trump administration that's doing everything within its power to be restrained. But at a certain point, restraint becomes negligence. We begin sacrificing our position and inviting more and more escalating attacks. And at one point, one of those attacks is going to be something really catastrophic, something we can't afford to ignore. And we'll lose a lot of face and strategic initiative in the process. That's why preventative retaliatory strikes are sometimes desirous, because you don't want to sacrifice the loss that would result in a defensive strike or retaliatory strike yourself. So we're getting really close to that point. I think we're at the point, but the Trump administration doesn't appear to. Restraint is a valuable strategy as long as it works. If it doesn't impose the kind of costs on your adversary that you're trying to impose, then you have to pursue politics by other means. And I think we're getting really close to that point.
Yeah, and there's, I think, excuse me. I think Trump had a brief kind of news conference today with reporters, and they asked about Iran, and he did one of his usual things, which he has been known to do. He doesn't give an answer. He doesn't say yes or no. It's always like, we'll see, or, you know, we'll find out soon enough. I think it's one of those answers that people get kind of like they get the vapors over. But he's been known to do that so many times over so many issues, and then nothing ever happens. So this whole idea that, you know, now the reports will come out, he's contemplating it, they're thinking about attacking Iran, when
it is completely divorced. Yeah, I'm sorry I'm interrupting, but your observation is absolutely spot on. It is so obnoxious, the way in which this is being covered. You remember in early May, we had this New York Times story that blew the doors off the political conversation. The White House was reviewing military plans against Iran in echoes of the Iraq War. And one of those plans was to dispatch 120,000 troops to the region. These are called contingencies. They exist for everywhere on the planet Earth. And yes, we have them, and the Pentagon reviews them, and sometimes they're put before the president. The president has demonstrated no interest. And in fact, it says in the story how much he is disinterested in engaging in deployments. It would contravene his promises on the campaign trail. And like you say, in the first tanker attack, which was a really substantial assault on the international order, the American-led international order. And he's asked by reporters, you know, what are you going to do to respond to Iran? And his response was, it's going to be a bad problem for Iran if something happens. But something happened. It did happen. This is like he's talking about this in the conditional tense. It happened already. What is the response? And there was none forthcoming, because he doesn't want to respond. I'm divorced entirely from the thought process of the media here, because in the press, Trump is behaving recklessly and aggressively. In my view, he's acting very weak. He's demonstrating that Iran can test its parameters and hasn't yet reached the point at which American resolve will mobilize to impose costs on Iranian actions. And when that happens, you get more tests. It begets more tests until Iran comes up against a hard barrier. Hasn't reached that barrier yet. And the next time it's going to, and it's going to test us again. And when it does, it's going to be worse.
Right. And then it'll be interesting to see if people start questioning Trump in the media about his supposed weakness. Like, you're already saying it is, and it's fair to say. But of course, what they're saying now is he wants war, but he's not actually doing that. And then if Iran continues to escalate, then the questions will surface. Well, when is Trump going to do something about this? It's kind of this game that goes back and forth, and it gets exhausting after a while. I guess after 2.5 years, it's something that's just you get tired of, but you know it's going to happen. It's going, that is the kind of escalation it takes. But, there's this particular route that you can always follow. The questions are going to come in. And so we'll just have to wait and see what happens. Okay, so Ben Howe is here. He's joined us. Ben, you there?
I am here. How are you?
All right. Hey, Ben. Okay, so let's talk about social media. And no, I'm not sure how much you've read about this, but I'm sure you've read about Senator Josh Hawley's bill that he introduced, which would, this is all related to Facebook and Twitter and companies like that, having the safe harbor provision of the 1996 Communications Act, section 230, something CDA, section 230, whatever it's referred to, which is where Facebook and Twitter, even though they weren't specifically enshrined in that law because it's 23 years old, they fall under it as a platform, like a blog. They are not responsible for the content that somebody puts on Facebook. So seemingly if Ben goes and accuses, person X of being a pedophile or whatever, Facebook is not responsible for that. The person can sue Ben. What Josh Hawley's bill wants to do is strip that protection and basically make Facebook and Twitter and other social media outlets over a certain size with a certain amount of revenue publishers, which would have go through a process of proving that when they're curating their content, they're not doing so in a politically neutral way. It's kind of a ridiculous bill. They have to demonstrate, and here's the text, by clear and convincing evidence that they do not negatively affect a political party, political candidate, or political viewpoint through their content curation. So it's stunning because they're requiring Twitter, for example, to prove a negative that they didn't do this. And this is one of these kinds of things. It's a Pandora's box. You have conservatives. I wouldn't necessarily say conservatives. I would say more Trump people, the Trump Republicans. I think it's easy to make a distinction now between conservatives and Trump Republicans who are cheering this on and want this to happen because for some reason they think it's going to prevent them, that they can go on to Twitter or Facebook and they can say whatever they want and they're not going to be able to get kicked off. Because
you're giving them motives I don't think they have. Their motive is not to ensure, protections of what they want to say. It's to make sure that they can stay on a platform where there's a chance Jake Tapper will reply to them. Like this is about people feeling like they've earned a certain amount of influence on a social media platform and being afraid that they are going to be targeted and kicked off. And rather than stay a conservative free market principled person, they really like, well, the fight's bigger than that, and so we have to take extreme measures in order to deal with it. But like, the goal here is really just protecting the identity that they think they've built.
In Josh Hawley's case, what he's not after passing legislation, because he knows this isn't going to pass. And even if it did, it probably wouldn't support constitutional muster. I mean, his objective seems to be to get a talking point onto the TV shows. He's been an extraordinary disappointment. He's an extremely bright guy with a real credibility to his name, and could have been a real asset to the conservative cause. And his impulse seems to be that he knows which way the wind is blowing and has got to ride the populist wave, even if it doesn't comport with constitutional norms or conservative ethos. I'm more inclined to sort of understand where the genuine populist is coming from, even if I think they've worked themselves up into a froth and created this crisis culture that doesn't exist in order to justify their the extreme measures they want to take. So even if it's an intellectually dishonest construct, at least it's a construct I can understand. I don't think Josh Hawley thinks that way. I think he understands exactly what he's doing and doesn't really believe the scope of the threat that he's seeking to address, but is seeking to ingratiate himself with an electorate.
I'm getting so tired of, you know, I believe in media bias, and I think it will be difficult to look at the way the media conducts themselves and conclude that there isn't bias. But having been around in this world as long as I have, the amount of things that become a impediment to conservatism as being against us and so don't trust it, and this is fake news and that is fake news. And it's like they want to discredit any platform or any outlet or any organization that doesn't echo conservative ideas, which seems like a bad idea, too. And it's like a this perpetual victim mentality. I mean, you know, I used to go on MSNBC before, and no, I know you're on there. And what was funny to me all the time was how I'd go on there and then they would condemn me for going on there. And I was like, I don't understand. You said there's media bias and you want more diversity of opinions in these places. And then I go on there and now I'm a sellout for going on there. I mean, isn't this what we wanted? Or I love how, you know, everybody, the New York Times is fake news. It's fake news. And then they're all running around to pat each other on the back and congratulate each other when one of them gets mentioned in an article there. You know, right. It's just a bunch of it's that conspiracy theory element on the, and I'm sure it's on the left as well, but it's on the right that has this kind of victim mentality that's just taken over. I can't stand it.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously anybody who's done a little bit of thinking about this, you know, knows that it's probably a bad idea to cede to a set of unelected regulators in the fourth branch of government the capacity to demonstrate what is and is not acceptable political speech, a body that conservatives wouldn't control from minute one and certainly wouldn't have control of from perpetuity. But, you know, also it just kind of concedes that you can't win in the arena of ideas, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that you simply just cannot compete. In fact, you don't really want to compete. You simply want to rig the game in your favor. And that's an intellectually and morally indefensible instinct.
They are embracing the unsubtle version of what you just said, though. I mean, it used to be that there were excuses made, you know? Like, I was against a lot of the bailouts and a lot of the, you know, the auto bailouts and TARP and everything else. And I was especially against when Bush said that he abandoned the free market system to save the free market. You know, I didn't like those things, but they were trying to be subtle at least about it. But now with the new rules, as Schlichter's always talking about, they're just flat out saying, no, we just we're going to rig it because we have the power right now. And hopefully we can keep it going. I mean, they're not even attempting to pretend that there's principles guiding this. It is truly just, we have power, we're going to wield it, and we're going to try to solidify it.
Well, yeah, but they also, I'm sorry, just one thing. They're also, please, like, mixing in that victimhood mentality that we talked about. They're being silenced. They're making us less free. I saw some threads today on Twitter where people are actually comparing, getting kicked off Twitter to comparing it to Black people not being able to sit at a lunch counter in the South in the 1950s, you know, so it's like, if a business has to accommodate me, then how is Twitter any different? You know, and I basically said, sure, Twitter is open. You can go in and a person can go into right now. They can walk in and they can sit down at a diner. They can sit down at the counter. But if they start screaming about how a pizza parlor in D.C. is a cover for a child sex ring, and then they start going around screaming in all the other customers' faces, the owners have the absolute right to kick him out and tell him never to come back. And that's what we're facing here. It's not as though Alex Jones couldn't get on Twitter or they're not allowing him to register an account. And that's where they're falling short, but they're sitting there actually comparing themselves to the civil rights movement in the South in the late 50s and early 60s.
It also defies recent history. I mean, Trump's advantage was social media, and it was a huge part of what got him elected. And let's face it, if Trump suddenly decided, you know what, I'm going to get off Twitter and I'm going to go to Gab or, you know, whatever's still around, do you think that, like, nobody would go Do you think that all the journalists who hang on his every tweet would not suddenly move over to whatever platform he's on? So the leader of the Republican Party and essentially the conservative movement at this point has the power to shift every single important person on Twitter over to a different platform. But somehow the conservative right is being silenced. I just don't see it. I understand that they do tend to target speech on the right over speech on the left. I get it. And I think that the way that you fight that is the same way you'd fight any customer service situation, which is you yell at the business. And if that's not good enough, you leave. And if you're not willing to leave, then shut up. Like you vote with your pocketbook and your presence. And if you're not willing to do that, then I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, I'm skeptical about the notion that there's a justification for an antitrust suit targeting Facebook, for example. But I'm willing to at least suspend my cynicism for a minute to see what the case is. However, I mean, we're not even talking about an unfair competition angle here, right? What we're talking about really is that just this one political movement doesn't feel like it's interests are being seen to, or rather even favored almost, by a private enterprise. And if you were to reverse the partisan roles there, conservatives would be out of their minds, outraged over the attempt to game the refs and to shape the commercial environment in order to have some sort of a political advantage. I mean, they do so pretty freely when it comes to like the phenomenon of woke capitalism and woke brands appealing to this really shallow social justice sentiments, which is something that they're rewarded by their consumers, by the way. But they don't see the same impulse in themselves, and it really is very confusing. I understand that. I understand the psychological desire, the psychological need to ramp up every threat into an existential threat to justify your actions and your behaviors that would otherwise be antisocial and unconstitutional and generally looked down upon, frowned upon by society. But that doesn't that concedes kind of how unhealthy this impulse is.
Mm-hmm. And they did this with the right did lose their mind when the Fairness Doctrine was on everybody's lips back in the 90s, and it was essentially the same issue where the left just wasn't finding their footing in terrestrial radio. And right. So they wanted the government to force it to happen. But the most ridiculous part here is, at least when they were doing that, not that I agreed with it, but at least when the left was being upset that they didn't have a foothold in terrestrial radio, they actually did that.
They were right. Yeah.
Yeah. <You know? laughs> Ben, you and I have talked about this before. You know, it's always the people that who are out there that have followings of 1,300,000, 500,000 people on Twitter talking about how they're getting oppressed by these social media companies. These liberal tech companies are so oppressing us. Oh, by the way, here's a link to my book.
Yeah, so, exactly. The other thing is what's funny to me about the whole breaking them up thing. I mean, again, if you're talking about Facebook, that may be one thing. But when you're talking about Twitter, I just watched a video the other day. It's literally like the bottom of the barrel in terms of users among all the top 10 social media websites.
Right.
It's like, what's going to be the justification for saying that the smallest of them needs to be broken up? I don't
see
it. And
break it up into what? How do you break up Twitter?
I don't know. Break it up into like mentions and then like the
you have
main
to have a mentions app and a notifications app.
Right.
Two different Twitter apps.
Owned by two different companies with two different CEOs.
Speaking of, you know, all this stuff about social media, talking about the whole lib owning thing, which is a big thing amongst the.
But we're not going to talk about Jack Dorsey's sex machine, are we?
No. We're going to talk about the NRA. Okay. And how there seems to be, there's a story that just broke very recently about the NRA, in fact today, that they are hemorrhaging money and that they have unpaid bills, and what may have to do in order to catch up is to shut down NRA TV. And I don't know if either of you guys follow non-white hat. He used to be one of the contributors of Pope Hat's Twitter account or their blog, but he says idea maybe the NRA was unwise to in deviating from its original mission of providing firearm safety training and legal advocacy on one issue rather than attacking Thomas the Tank Train in a culture war. And everybody remembers when NRA TV hired our favorite person, Dan Bongino, and he did the somehow or another, what do you have when you have lemons? You make lemonade, and he threw a bunch of lemons into a blender, and it was supposedly some kind of like brilliant marketing scheme. But I'm wondering if, and if we see this, and I hope we do, and Noah, you know, let me let your thoughts on this. I'd really like to see a crack in the armor of the lib owning kind of conservatism. And hopefully I was baffled the other day before yesterday. Rob Louie at the Heritage Foundation tweeted out, so excited to have Seb Gorka here from whatever station he's at with his guest, Emerald Robinson from OAN. And I didn't really say anything, but Amanda Carpenter just replied, seriously? The question mark. And that is the type of conservatism that right now is sits at the top. It's not
Jay. It's Dr. Seb Gorka.
Sorry. Yeah, he'll unblock me and yell at me and then go back to blocking me. But sooner or later, I would like to get back to what we're still seeing practiced at like AEI, that kind of conservatism. And do you think that there's, let me ask you this, and we can segue into the 2020 election as we're talking about this. Assuming, let's say for a second, we'll just assume that Trump loses in 2020. Does his type of Republicanism, I'm not going to call it conservatism, does that get stronger with a loss? Do people go further? Or do people sit back and say, maybe this was not a good idea? What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, because part of the strangest phenomenon of the Trump era is that it's the movement that adheres to whatever Trumpism is, fancies itself the victim, the loser in this situation, even with the president in the White House. And this is one of the things I didn't really weigh in very heavily on, the whole Sarah Bomari versus David French thing. In part because I thought it was so silly, but also because I'm friends with them all and I'm colleagues with them all, and I just didn't want to get too deeply involved in it. But the observation that I took away from all that is the extent to which Donald Trump's control over the conservative movement is so entirely cosmetic. When the party that occupies the White House has power, to say nothing of at least one chamber of Congress and all these governorships and all these state legislatures, when a party's in power, they talk about program and policy, and they organize around program and policy, and they put all their efforts into pushing for one legislative achievement per week. And have, you know, remember Infrastructure Week? That's like a big joke, but that's how administrations operate. They dedicate themselves to a particular agenda item that's very narrow, circumspect, and achievable. And they muster all their forces in that direction. And then when that's achieved, they move on to the next one. That's not happening with the Trump administration, in part because Donald Trump doesn't have an agenda. So the kind of giant ideological schismatic debates that are occurring on the right are also occurring on the left, which is natural. When you're out of the power and out of White House, you have those kind of fractious, internecine ideological bouts of combat in order to position yourself and your party for the next time that you're in power. But that's happening while this party is in power, which suggests that this is really just sort of a holding period. And if that is true, and Donald Trump loses in 2020, and I suspect it would be resolved if he were to survive, if he were to win in 2020, I suspect that ethos would be cemented. But if he were to lose, we'd probably just go back to 2015. We'd really probably just engage in the very same debates that we were having back then about how conservative Republicans are quisling saboteurs who undermine the project and who have no ideological affinities and don't fight. And the other side of the aisle would say, well, this is a failed experiment, and being churlish for its own sake is kind of counterproductive. And we'd be having the same arguments that we had this time 3.5 years ago. So that seems to me the most likely course of events if Donald Trump were to lose. Who's going to be the victor of that conversation? I don't know. Donald Trump won last time, but there aren't very many avatars of Trumpism outside of Donald Trump that's not in the blogosphere. In the activist grassroots, there's a lot of aspiring Trumpers, But mm-hmm. in the actual political arena, people with elected office, there aren't too many, which is why folks like Josh Hawley and, to a lesser extent, people like Marco Rubio, who are sort of nodding in the direction of populism and putting on this what I can really only say is a display and a front, because I don't think they really believe it, think that's the way the wind is blowing. But in the absence of that wind in their sails, would they adhere to that persona, which I don't think is genuine? I don't know. Probably not.
I've been going back through some of my old tweets because I've got about 150,000 of them over the last 10 years. And the further back I go, the more I come to a realization, you know, starting in 2009, which was, I was pretty MAGA like back in 2009, 2010, long before Trump came on the scene. And, you know, he was a presence starting in about 2011. But I've always thought of him as sort of co-opting a language that was already, you know, pretty widespread on the right, in the blogosphere and on Twitter and elsewhere. And I've always felt like he used his salesmanship to channel it and did something that previously had not been done, which was to absorb that sort of culture we had on the right, that sort of MAGA-ish culture on the right, into governance. Whereas with Bush, for instance, I recall when there were times that he was not giving like the punch you in the face response, and we kind of knew that's because he knew we would. And there was this sort of separation between like the people in the trenches fighting in the dirt and the people in government trying to have some air of diplomacy about them. And with Trump, he just brought that whole thing into the White House and into the power structure. And I don't see how, if he loses, given what we've already talked about how the everything is either spun as incredible, unbelievable, unprecedented victory, or proof that the liberal media complex is designed to victimize conservatives, it seems like they'll only go, if they win, then it's the, you know, unprecedented victory thing. If they lose, I can't imagine it's not going to be a doubling down. And it's I have a hard time picturing the, you know, Reince Priebuses of old coming back in and saying, okay, the grownups are back in the room now. Like, I think that if MAGA culture existed before it was called MAGA, it was a small part of the population that was on social media and in the blogosphere. And in the era of Trump, it has spread out like a virus into the general Republican Party. I random people that I talk to now that don't even get on Twitter, they sound exactly like somebody I would have argued with on Twitter.
Yeah, it's everywhere. But that's propagated by folks on radio and television who are acting in service to power. They're mimicking power. And when that power is gone, that impulse declines slightly. Not entirely, but it declines slightly because the rewards are no longer there. There's something different about a one-term president. We don't have a whole lot to look at in the post-war era. There's only two of them. And they're pretty much spent forces when they lose their re-election bids. And those who adhere to their movements and their style are going to seem like the ancien regime in a certain sense, a little bit hidebound. So there's definitely going to be an opening and a room in the conservative movement for something a little bit more aggressive, I think.
Well, I would say, though, that I've had a theory that I've been thinking about on this, about those one-term presidents. And what I realized is there's presidents who win on talent, and then there's presidents who win for different reasons. And the ones who win for different reasons are often the one-term presidents, and the ones who win on talent are often the two-term presidents. Trump is a talent president, in my opinion. He's not one of those guys that got in because he was the vice president for the previous, or because he was going up against Gerald Ford, who was himself only there because of Nixon. Like, it's there's no mitigating circumstances that can assign this to anything other than Trump having the talent to win, which is a unique talent this time. Whereas with Reagan and Bush, it was that they were affable, or with Clinton and Obama, it was their political savvy. With Obama, or with Trump, it's that he's like a dick, you know. And I think that with his talent, if he were to have one term, If he was to lose the election, I think it would be a very unique circumstance, because there's not much devotion for those one-term presidents. That's why they don't win. And there's a lot of devotion for this guy. If he loses, I just have to imagine it's going to send the legions of his devoted followers into a tailspin that would not be the same as when Bush 41 lost. There was a lot of, yeah, that makes sense. They're not going to say that this time.
Yeah, but
I don't think that's true at all.
Yeah,
I don't see this president as having a unique talent that got him into the White House. I think he was up against one of the worst competitors ever to run for the office, who suffered twice from the intervention of the FBI with these half-hearted exculpations. I don't see him having this particularly robust following. He's up against a very hard ceiling in his job approval rating, around 42%, which isn't good. And if he were to lose in the election, whatever happens in the election, we're going to say, oh, that was obvious. If he wins, it's because, well, you know, look at the state of the economy. Look at the stability of the government. It's obvious he was going to win. If he loses, that's going to be obvious, too. Because he's a really unpopular guy who somehow couldn't get above 42% despite having full employment.
We don't nominate presidents for parties based on the devotion of the general electorate. We do it based on the more active members of the Republican Party, and they are extremely devoted to him. They're devoted to him and his identity and his personality even more so than his policy. He could have not accomplished
during the primaries.
What do you mean?
It took us all the way into May, and he never crested above 30% in the polls.
He came in at number one. He stayed in the lead the entire time.
No. Early on, he didn't.
When he lost the Iowa caucus
in a 16-person field, and go look at the RCP average. He never crested above 30% until late April.
He still got more primary votes despite that than any other previous candidate.
Right, but that's because by the time once you cross the threshold,
I'm shocked that y'all don't think he has a devotion.
I'm sure they don't think it's large enough.
I don't think it has anything to do with him. I think it's because he's the president and the leader of the party.
Oh, there was never this kind of devotion for Bush. Never. There was never this kind of devotion for Bush. There was this kind of devotion perhaps for Reagan, but I have never seen people go through this many cartwheels and shed this many principles and do this much insanity in the name of supporting one.
I am old enough to remember 2001 through 2003. And yes, there was this kind of devotion and cartwheeling and spinning for George W. Bush. Well, and there wasn't a whole lot of love for Ronald Reagan in certain points of his presidency. There's a lot of revisionism in that review.
But what were the cartwheels that they had to do for Bush to explain how there was not enough spending cuts in light of the tax cuts
for Bush in the run-ups to the Afghan and the Iraq war? Yeah, there was a lot of spin.
Or his reelection. Yeah. Look at his reelection effort.
I mean, 2004 reelection.
The Medicare Part D had already passed. I mean, that was already there. There was already the increased spending, but it was basically, you're either going to elect me, who's a strong war leader, or you're going to elect the guy
right.
who
I mean,
throws medals
on the right. You're making my case for me. You're telling me that he wasn't as popular.
The bottom didn't fall out for George W. Bush, and it fell out fast when it did, but it didn't fall out until 2006, 2007, after he lost the House and the Senate.
It fell out in part because the economy crumbled and he seemed to do what the Democrats wanted to do because they had the majority.
No, because hold on, because you're saying he wasn't as popular. I am saying that he had a stronger base of support over. I mean, I didn't say base of support. I say stronger overall support going into the 2004 election than Trump does now. When Bush, towards the end of 2008, when Bush's approval rating was around 30%, that's what Trump has right now. That's the devoted following. Is that 30%? The others are just your general Republicans who were saying, "Yeah, he's a Republican. I hate the media. Democrats are bad, and we're going to vote for him." But just we have to consider the fact that he won. And like Noah said, he beat one of the worst presidential candidates, probably the worst presidential candidate of all time, and he won by approximately 70,000 votes, which was what tipped the scales for him on the Electoral College.
Absolutely,
and I don't think he can repeat that.
Listen, you still had people that are of the vein of Kurt Schlichter at that time saying that this wasn't their choice, but they're going to hope that he does best. They're not saying that anymore. They're saying he's the best thing that's ever existed. And if you think that they're just saying what they would have said for Bush or Reagan, I think you're wrong.
I absolutely do. I will place bets with you guys.
Do you think Marco Rubio, I think
Rush Limbaugh would be doing the exact same shtick he's doing now in service to power.
I was using Kurt as a personality type. I mean, obviously, pundits are always going to do that. What I'm saying is I'm talking about the general population, the rallies that he pulls, the types of people. I live down here in rural South Carolina, and I can tell you these people are fanatical for this guy. Fanatical.
Well, maybe fanatical for the wrong reasons. And that, you know,
it doesn't
matter
why.
OK, but what I'm saying is still going back to that. You can have those fanatics out there. Kurt voted for Trump. So him being fanatical about Trump this time doesn't change anything because he's going to vote for him again. I think it's probably the same people. What is he going to do? Vote harder? Of course.
I mean, like,
well, there's also something to this president, the question was whether or not
it's going to stick around. That was the question. So
there is something to this president that is unique when, in terms of devotion, in that he requires it of his supporters. He's not comfortable with. And his supporters are not comfortable with even limited dissent, in part because he is so thin-skinned, and also in part because there is no agenda. The agenda is the man. And so the man suffices for commitment to the movement. And that's something that is a little bit unique, and that's why I think you do see a little bit more fanatical devotion to the individual as opposed to the movement, because this president doesn't see himself as a vehicle for a movement. He is the embodiment of the movement in his mind. They're inseparable. That's a little different from, I think, past presidents.
Last thing I'll say in defense of my view on this. I think that y'all are discounting.
Your incorrect view. But go ahead.
Yes, I think y'all are discounting. I think that y'all are discounting just how chaotically horrible he is. I mean, like when you say something like, yeah, he beat them, but barely, or he beat Hillary, but barely. It's like, yeah, but you have to, like, if Ted Cruz or George W. Bush or whoever, like a normal politician, had barely beat Hillary, then I would hear these arguments. But when you are a walking disaster like this guy is, and you still manage to pull those things off, I just don't see how you could possibly attributed to anything other than a unique set of skills and talents. He has them. I don't like them, and I don't like how he uses them, but I think it's crazy to think he doesn't have them. I don't think anybody said that he wasn't a talented political actor. He's a two-term level talented.
Quite possibly, but I also think you're ascribing to him superhuman traits here that I can't really support in objective reality. I mean, he's won in precisely one election in his life.
And throughout the news cycle of his we've gotten to a point now where he can jump on Twitter without even consulting his generals and announce that he's going to bomb fucking Iran into smithereens. And it's just Thursday. I mean, he's changed the way people cover the news because his insanity is so expected that nobody even bats an eyelash.
Everyone's moved on to covering AOC and her comparison to the border crisis, to concentration camps.
I mean, look, the bottom line is the guy needs to build his base. The guy needs to build his base. He can't win with the same coalition of voters, most likely, unless you have an exact reprise of the 2016 election and a really dispirited Democratic electorate, which I don't think is going to happen.
No.
He has to build the base. He has to attract new voters. So the Kirschlichters aren't going to do it. He's going to need more voters.
The thing is, the base of liberals that are okay with everything AOC says, for instance, or everything that the woke social media mob brigades go after. The amount of liberals on the left, or the amount of center left people even, that are okay with that is far less than the amount of center right people that are okay with the things that Trump does. And I think that if you're seeing a push in one direction or another, I find that most people who are upset about the way the woke world is working and the way that it's I just read a story the other day about this woman who has a farmer's market booth in like rural Indiana, and five Antifa organizations and a women's march organization and a couple of others all banded together to get her banned as a white supremacist because she knew somebody who was in the alt-right. And they succeeded, by the way. And I think that that kind of stuff moves people to the center. And in the center, looking at the future with that kind of control over people's speech and what they're allowed to do and what they have to be offended by and who they have to be careful around and so on and so forth, they're going to be much more likely to embrace Trump, who's saying, screw everyone.
Right, but there's also, there's another side to that. You have people who aren't, who don't really know what about all this wokeness stuff. They couldn't tell you who Antifa is. And I the thing that worries me when it comes to, and I'm not so much worries me, but what should worry Trump and people in his reelection campaign should worry about are people, when I lived in Texas, in the 32nd Congressional District in Texas, which was held by Pete Sessions, and he lost. It's those suburban voters who have been upset by Trump, who have been annoyed by Trump, and that was Noah was talking about, was this high line of like 42 or 43% approval at a time when the economy is doing great, when unemployment is ridiculously low, when we're not at war with anyone. We have the usual kind of struggles going on in the Middle East. Crime is relatively low. You know, there are not a lot of major problems in this country. And people, of course, say if Trump had stopped tweeting and just shut up, you know, he might get 7 or 8 points out of that in approval. That is going to be very difficult for him. And I understand there may be people that say, yeah, I'm sick of this kind of like far left wing stuff. But at the same time, I don't know how many of them are going to be motivated enough that they're going to go to the polls and vote for Trump. There are people, I think, that disingenuously say, the left made me do it. I just can't deal with this. I have to go vote for Trump. They always wanted to vote for Trump. They're just looking for an excuse to do it. But I don't know how much it's going to be. And if those people stay home, who did come out maybe in 2016, let's give this guy a chance, and then realize after 2 years, Jesus Christ, what was I thinking? I don't know. I don't like to make. I'm not going to make concrete predictions because I did that in 2016, and it. Right. Yeah, I still get to hear about, you've been wrong for 4 years. So it's.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah. So I'm not so much predicting who's going to win. I'm just talking about what culture is going to take over the GOP, and I think it's a lockdown. I think they're done, and this is what their culture is now. He may not win, but I think that this is the culture of the GOP.
See, now I think you're wrong. I think if somebody came along and like he lost. And after 4 years, Nikki Haley kind of rose from the ashes and decided that she would ditch the populist rhetoric she's kind of like espousing now. And I think probably if she went back to being a more George W. Bush type Republican, you would have the same people whining who whined about Romney in 2012. But at the end of the day, they're going to go ahead and they're going to vote for the Republican.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
What was all our bloviating about, like, destroying the conservative movement if it was not to prevent exactly what I'm saying will happen?
Well, I'm
saying literally that what we all worried would happen is going to happen.
I still think there's a difference between necessarily the Republican Party and the conservative movement, and that's a discussion for another day. We could probably take up another hour, but. And so we don't have a chance to get into the 2020 Democrats. We used up an hour here talking about it, but it was a great little spirited debate there. I think people will.
Oh yeah,
like
no, we don't get to do that much because I usually just agree with whatever you say.
So Noah was pushing back on Ben. He's like, I think you're wrong. He's like, yes, yes. So
no, I just struggle to think of who's going to assume the mantle of the post-Trump Trump. You know, Trump himself came from outside the Republican Party structure, and while people are mimicking him in a rather unconvincing fashion,
yeah, it looks
party,
silly.
It doesn't fit, right? It feels forced, and yes. I don't think they enjoy it. So, I mean, there's certainly going to be a market for it. I don't argue that, but who's going to be the genuine avatar of that sort of nihilistic, self-destructive expression of anxiety? I struggle to see how it would come from inside the political tent, and then you're saying, okay, maybe lightning strikes twice and somebody from outside the environment comes in and assumes that mantle. Well, maybe, but I mean, very speculative at that point. It seems to me that there are more potential successors, again, all predicated on the assumption that he loses, more potential successors within the Republican establishment who would prefer the status quo ante, the ancien regime, than to assume this really prickly affectation that really only Donald Trump can do well. Everybody who's tried it has failed. to replicate his success at the ballot booth.
Right, because nobody else has the sociopathic tendencies that he does. When you look at the way that he just spouts lies, I mean, the demonstrable lies without even thinking about it. It just, they just come out of his mouth naturally. I don't think
there were a lot of lack, his inability to feel shame or embarrassment is probably, because if he feels embarrassment, he deals with it by raging or getting revenge or cutting somebody off or blacklisting him or firing them.
There were
he doesn't
a lot of
actually
mini,
deal with it.
There were a lot of mini Trumps who ran in 2018 in statewide races, and all of them lost.
That is true. Words to live by, people. Listen to that. So, hey, Noah, thanks again for coming on. Appreciate it. It's probably the second podcast you recorded today. Am I right?
Yes.
Okay. So the reason why I'm saying that is because Noah is part of the commentary podcast, which you should also be listening to.
Oh, yes.
So that's great. So, but
I want to be influential and popular enough that I have to think for a second when somebody asks me if it was my second podcast yeah. of the day.
Maybe the third or the fourth.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
That was just exhaustion. Thank you very much, guys. This has been great. A lot of fun. And thanks for plugging the commentary podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. And make sure you check out Noah on commentary. And then, you know, what's fun is to go when Noah appears. Noah's you're still an NBC contributor, right? Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. So when Noah goes on MSNBC, 10 minutes after he appears, go look at his mentions on Twitter, because it's an actual it's a delight. Because whenever he takes up a position that seems to be anywhere near in the atmosphere of defending Trump, it lights up like a pinball machine.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to wallow in my own sense of grievance here, but I really did blow it today, though. We had Representative Joaquin Castro on, and I asked him a question about a statement that he had made and critiqued it a little bit and asked him to respond to the critique. And he informed me that that was his brother.
Oh boy!
Yeah,
that's a tough one.
Did you go?
No,
viral
I curled up into a little ball of insecurities and shrank under the table, and slunk out of the studio.
You should have like slammed whatever papers down were in front of you, and then just gone. Well, answer
Damn
for
it.
Your brother, sir.
Who did this? Who did this to me?
Well, thanks again, Noah. I know, make sure if you haven't bought it yet, go read Noah's great book on Just. You could buy it on Amazon and other places where you can find your favorite political tomes. Ben Howe, where can everyone find you?
You can find me in the Twitterverse, going around and causing trouble and not being banned for it. And you can go to Amazon and order or pre-order my book, The Immoral Majority. Coming out August 13.
August 13. And Jay Caruso, the lesser, who is not, quote unquote, an author, the way the way Noah and Ben are, doesn't have a book yet. So you can only have to read what I write in the Washington Examiner magazine. And you'll find me from time to time at The Independent. And, of course, you could sign up for my newsletter, The Monday Notice.
Technically, right. I'm not an author yet, by the way.
Well,
I'm a pre-op. I'm like, it's like being pre-op. I'm like pre-author.
Yeah, but unless something happens that comes out and finds out about your past that involves like...
Why do you think I'm going through my old tweets?
It's getting ready for a purge. Leading the worst of them. All right, everyone, that's going to do it for this week. We will see you next time on the 5th State.